This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Richard Aidy with a question. Which economic measure has both grown enormously and almost completely disappeared? We'll get to the answer a bit later on The Money. Also, you've probably heard politicians from both sides talking about boosting manufacturing. Well, we'll hear what they should do if they actually mean it. We've had four worldwide recessions in the last 50 years, 1975, 82, 91 and 2009. And according to one of the world's most eminent economists, we might be heading for a fifth. Kenneth Rogoff is Professor of Economics at Harvard University. Kenneth, can I get you to start with the definition of a global downturn?
Well, to be honest, there's not a crystal clear definition that everyone agrees on of a global recession. For an advanced country like Australia, the United States, it's pretty clear that, you know, output turns negative for a while. For the world economy, there are countries like China that never seem to have a literal recession. So the definition of global recession is having growth at something like 2 or 2.5%. But we're certainly in danger of that or worse. And China might have its first ever time where it actually has a negative growth rate. You know, how can that be? Doesn't that ever happen? Well, when you're growing at 8 or 10%, going down to 2% is really terrible. And, you know, they don't grow at 8 or 10% anymore. It's slowed to 5 or 6. But right now, they may be teetering on being negative. I wish I had a crisp answer to your question, but I'm pretty sure they're going to decide it was a global recession.
Well, journalists always seeking crisp answers, even when they don't exist. But let's talk about China first, because you've identified three major economies or economic areas heading down. China, obviously very important country to us here in Australia. What are the specifics affecting their economy?
Well, clearly the immediate thing is a COVID lockdown with no obvious exit strategy. And they have a political problem that they have to escape from. In the meantime, they have, I don't know what percent, call it 10% of the population in home imprisonment at any one time. Big cities like Shanghai and Beijing, it's tying up the ports. So they have that, but they have longer term problems also. They have property having way overvalued, construction taking much too big a share of their production. They build houses nobody lives in. So a lot of imbalances in the Chinese economy, but then it's really getting slammed by COVID. It called it wrong and it's going to have to pay for it.
Yeah, and no sign yet of the Chinese leadership saying perhaps we've made a mistake. I'll turn to the US, Kenneth, because President Biden this week says inflation is his top priority. The latest figures are a tiny bit better. Annual rate of 8.3% in April after being 8.5% in March. What is happening in your country?
Our country is also having problems. They're different, but it's basically coming from getting too enthusiastic about having one stimulus after another and keeping interest rates too low for too long. And we brewed up quite an inflation. We have over 8% year on year, and it's not nearly under control. And we're in a situation where the economy is actually growing decently in spite of what's going on in Ukraine and in spite of what we just talked about with China. But still, they have to do something about this inflation that's out of control. And if the Federal Reserve starts raising interest rates, it's historically been very hard to do that with this kind of inflation without having a pretty significant recession. Now, that doesn't mean they'll do that. They may just let the inflation sit up there. That has its own problems. But it's a very difficult balancing act. And by the way, I think the major cause of the inflation was really over-enthusiastic stimulus for too long. Particularly after President Biden came in, he did this giant stimulus, which didn't really have any productive element to it. and left lots of money in everybody's pockets. And when they went out to spend it, it pushed prices up, not just for Americans, I think for the whole world.
Yeah. Well, let's move to Europe, which is, of course, is the third problem area. If the war in Ukraine continues, there will be pain not only in energy prices, you write, but also, as we discussed here on The Money last week, demand for military spend as well.
Well, I mean, Europe in some ways was in the best shape, but for the little problem of the war. But the war, of course, creates incredible uncertainty. We don't know how it's going to end. And the Europeans are having to confront, A, that they're overly dependent on Russian fossil fuels and they don't know how to dig their way out without a recession. And B, what you just said, they really have not been spending to defend themselves militarily. Even what they spend is very uncoordinated. The average age of their military is high. A lot of their equipment they're building is really not at a top tier because each country wants to have its own. And they really have to get their act together. The West has enjoyed this incredible peace dividend for decades and decades, the United States and Europe. And I think both areas are going to face much higher military spending going forward. And that's going to have to come out of something.
So with these the three most important economies in the world struggling, all for slightly different reasons, but all facing real problems, what does that mean for the rest of us?
It's a very volatile situation. I mean, it's not certain that it's all going to go down. Ukraine could settle in a couple of months and stabilize. We could find out that against all odds, the Chinese, who've incredibly competently managed their economy for decade after decade, did it again. We could find out that the Federal Reserve in the U.S. is able to achieve a soft landing. It could happen. But the problem is, if these things all go south, if that happens all at once, they sort of all feed on each other because we're worried about inflation in the United States. But if China has this continuing COVID problems that prevents them from exporting and ties up supply chains, that exacerbates inflation. It worsens demand in Europe, worsens their recession. It all bounces around. So it's a very volatile situation. I think the markets are sort of starting to pick up on the risk. It's, again, we don't know what's going to happen. It is a very uncertain forecasting situation. I was just at a conference where I was talking to a lot of top professional forecasters, and I was just amazed that one after another told me, you know, in my many, many years of doing this, I've never had such a difficult forecasting environment. It's so hard to tell what's next.
Now, one issue will be whether politicians and policymakers, come to that, are up to the task. Do you have concerns about that?
You're asking a rhetorical question or something. I mean, of course, I think it's politically so difficult to handle a situation where you've already been doing a lot of stimulus, so you can't easily do that. They can do some, but not a lot. Interest rates are starting out at phenomenally low levels, so there's not that much of that you can do. They don't have a lot of tools. And also, I think the understanding of what's going on is very misguided in a lot of places. Everyone's always fighting the last war and looking at this as we just need to create more demand. But if you look at what the pandemic did, if you look at what's going on in China, if you look at the war in Ukraine, a lot of this is a supply problem, that's a tougher punch to take. If there's less stuff being made for reasons like that, when you create a lot of demand, well, what happens is you get a lot of inflation. That's what the U.S. did. They misread what was going on and did everything they could to juice up demand, and there just isn't enough supply, and we're getting inflation. And the really tough things to do of making your economy more productive is very hard for politicians to do in a crisis.
Indeed. Interesting times, I think we can say, Ken.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for joining us today on The Money.
My pleasure. Good luck.
Kenneth Rogoff is Professor of Economics at Harvard University. This is The Money on Radio National and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Adey. Right at the end there of that last conversation, Ken Rogoff says the really tough things of making your economy more productive, very hard for politicians to do in a crisis. And that gets to our next story, except this time the constraint is an election, the one we're in now. Alan Kohler, the ABC's finance editor and columnist for The New Daily, says there's a particularly weird thing about this election.
We have a budget that's forecasting endless deficits for as far as the budget can see, sort of 20 years or so. And so there's no plan by either party to bring the budget back into surplus. Not a clear plan. I mean, the government is talking about how economic growth will eventually bring the budget into balance, but that's not a plan. I just think it's very interesting that there is no discussion this time around about going into surplus. There always has been in the past. And there are short-term things that it means, such as neither party wants to do anything particularly difficult that causes people any pain. So therefore, they're staying away from that. But I think that there are more fundamental things going on.
Okay, well, let's unpack it all. So the first thing I was struck by when I read your piece was that, you know, we've had a decade of the coalition in particular using debt and deficit as sort of cudgels to beat Labor with, and now neither side is talking about it.
That's right. And look, part of the reason is that the suggestion that Labor is worse at deficits, has bigger deficits, and is higher taxing than the coalition is not actually true. I mean, if you look at the past, as I've done, you go back to the beginning of the Whitlam government, 1972, the Labor Party in government has taxed less and had lower deficits than the coalition. Now, obviously, the coalition includes the pandemic last year, but still, even without that, it simply isn't the case that Labor is larger taxing and higher deficits than the coalition. So I think that kind of means that it's difficult this time around to trot that stuff out. I think they're obviously having a go at it, but, you know, it's difficult to do it.
But both sides are promising to spend a lot of money, or actually, rather, they're making promises that will cost a lot of money.
That's right. And this is where I think we can start to sort of get into the helicopter and look down at this, the big picture here, and that is that I think political parties in general are becoming more and more desperate to buy votes and are less and less inclined to talk about surpluses because of what it takes. And I think that over time, the demands on government have been increasing steadily, you know, the latest being the NDIS, but there's more to it than that. There's continual pressure on things like aged care, childcare, health, education spending, and also defence. You have this constant pressure on government spending, which the governments do not want to deny and say they're not going to do it because, you know, the last thing you want to do is say that you're not going to fully fund the NDIS. And so they're doing that spending. And at the same time, the pressure over the past few decades in particular has been to reduce taxes. Now, this has been particularly true of the Conservatives, and that follows on from basically from Ronald Reagan's big tax cuts in 1981 and 82 when he took over as President of the United States. And that really set the tone for all governments over the past 40 years to reduce taxes wherever possible, to keep them down. And even for progressive parties such as the Labor Party, it's very difficult for them to put up taxes, as we saw last election in 2019 when the Labor Party proposed that and then lost handsomely.
There's this increased spending, much more to come, as you've touched on the NDIS and defence, aged care, childcare. But if we're not going to raise more taxes, this is starting to sound like Boris Johnson's famous cake policy, Alan, of pro-having it and pro-eating it.
That's right. Exactly. Well, the coalition persists with this cap on tax to GDP of 23.9%, which is an arbitrary number that was just happened to be what the tax to GDP ratio was at the end of the Howard government in 2007. And so the coalition has kind of settled on that as being the forever cap on tax to GDP, which is ridiculous. It's kind of pulled from nowhere, and in particular, it doesn't have anything to do with what's needed to fund the government these days. I published a piece earlier this year talking about that and the limit on taxation that's become self-imposed, and compared that with the World Happiness Index to see which country is the happiest in the world. And the answer is Finland, and its tax to GDP ratio is 44%. And so I actually think there's a rule of thumb about satisfied, happy citizens, and that is any country with a tax to GDP ratio of above 40% is happy. If you look at the league table of tax to GDP ratios, those countries between 30 and 40% are happier, they're okay. Anyone under 30%, which includes Australia and the United States, is unhappy. The least happy country in the world is Afghanistan, according to that index, and its tax to GDP ratio is 7.5%.
There may be some other issues there too.
Well, that's the point. That's exactly right. Anyway.
You speak to a lot of people. Most economists I speak to would argue for tax reform. In fact, we've had them on the show arguing for tax reform in the last months, and that the total tax take has to go up. So how well is this understood by the political class?
Well, I've been talking to senior members of the ALP. There's no point talking to the coalition about this, but I've been talking to senior members of the ALP and saying that if you win government, you need to find a way to escape the 23.9% limitation on tax, and they agree. They all agree, but the last thing they're going to do is talk about that. And so the only tax reform proposal on the table at this election is the Labor Party's plan to increase the tax on multinational companies, which may, if they're lucky, raise $4 billion or so dollars. And that's it. You know, I mean, we're talking about increased spending in the tens of billions of dollars over time, over years, and no plans, apart from increasing the tax on multinational companies, to increase taxes.
Now, essentially, you've written, this isn't just a money problem. It points to a deeper problem with representative democracy.
Look, it's a relatively unformed kind of argument, but I just think that the system of democracy that we've got was set up in the 19th century when actually there was virtually no telecommunications, and representatives of each community went to the capital by train and represented their community and then came home and reported back. But now communication is instant. We know everything that the politicians themselves know, and we also know everything there is to know about them in a way that is perhaps, you know, not to their advantage. So I just think that knowledge is where sort of power lies. It used to be that politics was simply a battle between Labor and capital, where the Conservatives are on the side of capital and progressives are on the side of Labor, and they just fought it out. But it's much more complex than that, and the information we've got, and also energy has become another factor of production on top of labour and capital. There's energy and now there's knowledge, there's data. And so I don't think the system has sufficiently encompassed these changes, you know, and I think that one consequence of that is that the politicians are desperately trying to regain office by not increasing taxes and by increasing spending. And what you see is the endless deficits as a result of that. What I'm saying is that the politicians cannot find a way to be elected with a balanced budget because they have to spend so much, they think, and they can't tax enough.
Next week on the show, how to get it all sorted. thank you very much for joining us today, Alan.
It's a pleasure, Richard.
That very familiar voice is Alan Kohler. And if you haven't guessed already, the debt is the answer to the riddle at the top of the show. This is The Money with me, Richard Aidy. You probably noticed the images of politicians wearing high-vis in a factory talking about manufacturing. It's certainly come to the attention of Jesse Adamstein, who's at the University of Technology in Sydney.
We've heard bits and pieces from both the Coalition and Labor. The Coalition tends to spruik their existing strategy, which is called the Modern Manufacturing Strategy. They highlight technology investment, so it's very much about how technology will help us, and there's a big focus on minerals and space and defence. And Labor has sort of highlighted more things like becoming a country that makes things again. They've focused on NBN infrastructure, locally made transport. We've heard about EV buses in Perth, for example, and more emphasis on apprenticeship as well.
As a non-expert, just watching it, I have felt that it's sort of more about the vibe than specific detail from either of them.
Absolutely, because manufacturing is it's a winner issue, and no one really argues with the idea that local manufacturing is a good thing, right? Everyone thinks, that's great, we need to do that. No one is quite sure how, but it always is a winner issue. So it's very easy to do a high-vis photo op on manufacturing issues without necessarily spelling out a long-term plan.
All right. Say whoever wins the election is serious about boosting manufacturing and that this isn't just for the purposes of the election. What would they need to do?
Basically, we need to move past a scattergun approach or an approach that says the market will do this themselves. It really needs to be part of a coordinated national industry policy that looks at coordinating what we do with manufacturing with what we're doing in the energy sector and what we're doing with skills development, for example, and R&D. These things need to be tied together and taken in terms of a really long-term view.
I'll come back to that. But what are, I suppose, are the opportunities for Australia, a country that has really lost most of its manufacturing base?
Yeah, it is a problem. We do still have quite a lot of small to medium-sized businesses in manufacturing. They're not booming. A lot of them are struggling, but they are still around. So we need to actually make the most of those smaller to medium-sized businesses and ask them, what do you need to actually grow to be able to securely employ more people? But also look at really specialising. So rather than just supporting any old form of manufacturing, actually looking at where are the opportunities globally where we could look at both what a national market would want, but also an export market. And one area that's really booming right now is global green tech. So technologies associated with renewables infrastructure. That's absolutely set to just explode in the coming years. And Australia would do well to actually join in rather than kind of paddling at the back.
Yeah, and that will be an important part of our own energy transition as well. So
absolutely.
We're already doing some of this. We mine some critical materials like lithium and rare earths, like the lanthanides. We already mine and export, not big quantities, but we do that. Are you talking more of the same?
Critical minerals mining is going to be really essential in Australia. It needs to be done in an environmentally responsible way, but it is really important. But one of the things that we're not doing so well is actually processing those minerals locally. A lot of it gets reprocessed and then manufactured in other places, and then Australia ends up buying back, for example, batteries at great expense. So it doesn't make financial sense to ship off raw materials without actually enriching them here.
I think we do a little bit with lithium, but not anything like what needs to be done before it goes into a battery, for example.
And cobalt as well, it seems to be, there was a report on the ABC actually recently about how that's just starting. But it's really a nascent industry for us, and that I think could be a lot more focus on that. We could focus more on solar batteries, for example. There are some solar battery producers in Australia, but to my knowledge, there's only one that completely manufactures solar energy batteries. I think that's Sonnen in South Australia.
You say solar batteries, and I immediately think of what used to be, I suppose, the great rump of manufacturing in Australia, which is the car industry, which we don't have now. Are there any opportunities with electric vehicles?
Yeah, it's often seen that, you know, the car industry is dead in Australia. We do still have quite a lot of existing infrastructure that could be used for assembly, for example, and that there has been some work done on this. But also, rather than thinking about making it a whole electric vehicle, we can think about being a participant in a global supply chain. So actually identifying areas in the supply chain where supply is a real problem and identifying those target areas to sort of focusing on for both domestic markets and export markets.
We already have some linkages with universities. I think of Monash, where they do a lot of research on how to make what would be EV vehicles more efficient in terms of their drivetrains and things like that. So you can see how, with a bit of imagination and the details we'll get to in a minute, it might be possible.
Yeah, it also requires a government that is really willing to vocally support EV manufacture in Australia. And up to this point, we've actually found that at least on the national level, government has been very unwilling to support EV use and EV manufacturing and EV infrastructure. So it's not been a friendly industry for EVs up to this point, and I hope that that will change.
Yeah, there's been no encouragement to take up EVs, which is why we have one of the lowest penetrations in the wealthy part of the world of EVs.
Exactly.
What else, though? You touched on this earlier, JC, but what would government need to do, because it's a suite of things, isn't it, to make some of this happen?
One of the things that really needs to happen is you can't expand without a skills base. We really need to look back at what we're doing in terms of education. And this goes for everything from trades education right up to tertiary education. You need really qualified engineers, but you also need tradespeople. So really ramping up technical vocational education funding, looking at the ways in which businesses could be supported to hire more apprentices, making sure that those apprentices are getting support through TAFE at the same time so that the TAFE education is really working, that goes hand in hand with their workplace experience as well. Because you can't just rely on a business to train an employee. It's not enough these days. You really need to have, and it never was, you always need to have the vocational training component with it. So, and also identifying particular trades. There are massive skills shortages. There's quite a lot of work on skills shortages in sort of industrial sectors. Engineering fabrication, that's a suite of different trades, but there's always demand for people in engineering fabrication areas. You know, even things like boilermakers. Boilermakers are still in demand. Engineering pattern makers, very rare trade, but actually when you speak to employers, they're still looking for them.
This would require a reinvigoration of the apprenticeship scheme. And really, something more wide-ranging and fundamental for vocational education and training, because, as I don't have to tell you, TAFE is a shadow of what it was when I was leaving school. And what we have now is a much bigger private sector about which there's been some controversy and actually not a little fraud. That's not everybody, of course, but that we're talking about billions of dollars here. So it would require a lot of change.
Yeah, and I do think massive reinvestment in TAFE is essential if we want to actually start readdressing skills shortages in this way. And I do agree that the private training sector has been open to rorts. It's really problematic. It's, you know, a lot of government support has gone to what those private training providers, and that doesn't seem to have gone very well in a lot of cases.
This is not something that the next government is going to be able to flick a switch on.
No.
And by the time we get to the next election, it'll all be different. How long would this process take?
Look, if you think about industrial skills training, you're really looking at least a sort of 10-year projection to turn things around, I think. And if you think about an individual's skill lifetime, the apprenticeship that they gain when they're 16, 17, 18 years old carries them throughout their whole career and actually can really be foundational in the sort of work that they end up doing 20, 30 years ahead. So I think 10 years to really turn things around, but when we start looking even longer term than that, some interesting sort of possibilities for skills.
Yeah, and perhaps we could be a bit more like Germany or some of the Scandinavian countries that have really put the work in here.
Yes, potentially. I would also say that we're in a historical moment now where climate-related disasters could be a really serious issue, particularly for Australia in the next 30 years. So actually having fundamental materials knowledge and manual skills may be extremely important for things like just disaster recovery and survival. So it may be that we need manual skills for very different reasons than we might think we need them now.
On that slightly apocalyptic note, we'll wrap things up. Thank you very much for joining us on The Money.
Thanks, Richard. It's been a pleasure.
That's Jessie Adamstein. She's an ARC DECRA Fellow at the UTS School of Design. And that's it for this week. The Money is produced by Kate McDonald. Our sound engineer is Jennifer Parsonage. I'm Richard Adie.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.